I will talk about the theory of insurance for a little bit, and then I want to apply the theoretical arguments in particular to the area of health insurance a different heading for my lecture could also be from healthcare to welfare, because I want to show also the dynamics of interventionism in the healthcare market leading to successively worse situations. When it comes to insurance, Mises made an important contribution to this subject by introducing the distinction between what he calls class probability that refers essentially to risks that can be insured, and case probability, risky events against which one can not insure oneself, but for which one has to take individual responsibility. I should mention that remarks that Mises makes in Human Action about probability theory were to a significant extent influenced by the work of his brother, even though he does not acknowledge that. Ludwig von Mises' younger brother, 2 years younger, Richard von Mises, was one of the foremost mathematicians, statisticians in the 20th century, professor at Berlin, and then at the end of his life at Harvard. And he is the originator of the so-called frequency interpretation of probability. So much just for background information, the two brothers did not like each other that much. That does not mean that even if you hold a certain animosity towards someone, you might still learn from him. Let me explain some basic ideas about insurance. Any insurance involves the pooling of risks. It implies that to some of the insured people, more will be paid out than what they paid in the form of a premium, and to others, less will be paid out than what they paid in. If I insure myself against the risk of fire, for instance, then if my house burns down, then I obviously get more out than I paid in the form of premiums. And if my house does not burn down, then I paid more in than I got out of the insurance. But the key in all this is that no one of the insured knows in advance who the winners will be and who the losers will be. What I mean by winners is the guy whose house burned down. He is a winner. He got more out than he paid in. And what I mean by losers is, of course, the guy whose house did not burn down because he paid in vain and didn't get anything out of it. So just be aware of this definition of winners and losers. It is somehow a little bit counterintuitive, right? I mean, normally we just consider that to be the other way around, but you know what I mean. That is to say, the winners and the losers must be distributed randomly. No one can predict who will be a winner and who will be a loser. And the resulting income redistribution, you realize, of course, that there's an income redistribution going on within an insurance scheme. Distribution is unsystematic, unpredictable. Again, no one knows who will gain financially, so to speak, and no one knows who will lose financially. Otherwise, if the winners or losers could be systematically predicted, then the losers would not want to pool their risk with winners, but with other losers. And to give you an example of what I have in mind, let's assume we have an accident insurance, and the insurance company would pool my risk as a desk worker with the risk of a professional football player. And we are insured against getting bumps and broken bones and that sort of stuff. In that case, of course, it would be perfectly clear who will be the winner and who will be the loser. The football players, provided that we pay the same premium. If we would pay the same premium, then I can predict I will by and large subsidize the football players, because they have this risk occurring far more frequently than the risk occurs with me sitting behind the desk and rarely falling off my chair and hurting myself. So in this case, of course, it would be my desire to be that my risk be pooled only with other desk workers and not with professional football players. Now, competition between different insurance companies brings about precisely this result. That is, brings about a result where no misclassification takes place, where no systematically predictable income redistribution takes place. Unless, of course, the motive of voluntary subsidies on the part of some of the insured is involved. Obviously, the example that I just gave with football players and desk workers, if I'm a fanatic fan of football players, then I might subsidize. But if I'm not willing to subsidize football players, then as we will and competition eliminate all forms of systematic redistribution. In order to see this, just assume that a company did misclassify individuals as falling into the same risk pool, into the same group, while in fact they should be sorted out into different groups, the groups of desk workers versus the group of football players. Now, a firm that engaged in such a misclassification would be quickly outcompeted by another firm that does not engage in this type of misclassification. Why is that? Another firm that would discover, oh, there's a different risk between for desk workers as compared to professional football players, could of course offer risk of that group of people to be affected at hand, and the desk workers would be lured by a lower premium to just give up the old insurance company and insure themselves with the other one offering them a lower premium. And the misclassifying insurance company, on the other hand, would be stuck with the professional football players and would, of course, be forced to raise the premium accordingly, so that a correct sorting of people would occur and classes would correctly reflect the different risks of these different, the premiums would correctly reflect the different risks of the groups in question. Now, competition between insurance companies would then lead to ever more refined discrimination groups according to their actual group risks. Premiums would reflect this, the genuine insurance risk of these various groups and subgroups, and the price differentials, that is the differences in premiums, would reflect the different risks applying, the different degrees of risk applying to these various groups. Prices, premiums that have to be paid to the insurance companies, would on the average tend to fall, as they do in practically every area if there is no increase in the money supply. And the discrimination of people falling into this group based on numerous types of criteria. They might be based on regional, local, or geographical criteria. As, for instance, for flood insurance, hurricane insurance, earthquake insurance, and fire insurance. The likelihood of earthquakes is higher in some regions than it is others. The likelihood of being hit by tornadoes is obviously higher along the East Coast than it is on the West Coast, for instance. The likelihood of fire, again, might be different depending on the density of the population or the density of the allocation of housing units or the type of materials employed in these house constructions, and so forth. Or the discrimination, that is the distinction between different risk groups, might be based on biological or genetic criteria, such as sex, gender. Certain risks apply to women that don't apply to men. Certain risks apply to men that don't apply to women, and so forth. Women have a longer life expectancy than men have. What does that tell you? Genetic inheritance. You might have certain genetic equipment, positive or negative, that make you less or more prone to attract certain types of diseases, and then accordingly you would be classified differently. That might be distinctions such as race. There exist, for instance, certain types of diseases that occur almost exclusively among blacks, and other diseases that occur almost exclusively among whites. So there might be those types of criteria that are used in order to distinguish between various groups that classify individuals in groups. And finally, there might be, and you will see when I go along, that this is a more doubtful category. There might be behavioral criteria, such as being a drinker, or being a smoker, or being homosexual or heterosexual, or being in that occupation or being in a different type of occupation. As far as these behavioral criteria are concerned, we will see that there's a certain amount of doubt will come up whether insurance can really be using these types of criteria. Now, the next question that I want to address is what sort of events, what sort of risks can we insure against? And on the other hand, what sort of events are uninsurable events? Now, Mises points out that there are, in fact, uninsurable risks. We can subgroup and subgroup and subgroup, but there are also risks where we have to say there is no grouping possible at all, no pooling of risks possible at all. Accordingly, no insurance is possible. Such risks be individually. Now, which ones? First, addressing the question, what are the insurable risks? What conditions must be fulfilled in order to speak of a risk as something against which we insure ourselves? And there Mises writes the following. That is of what he calls class probability. So the condition that must be fulfilled in order to insurable risk is this. That means the insurer and the insured assume to know with regard to the risk concerned everything about the behavior of the whole class or group of events. So I assume to know everything about the risk of the whole group. Okay. But with respect to any particular event, that is me getting sick or you getting sick or your house burning down or my house burning down, with regard to any particular singular event or risk, we know nothing about it except that it belongs, that is a member of this class of risks about which we know all there is to know about. Let me give you an example. I must be in the following position. I assume to know everything based on long-run objective frequency distributions about the risk of hurricane damage to the residents of some specified territory. I have collected data over a long period of time. Now, this area is hit that and such at such and such a frequency, and the damage is of such and such magnitude and so forth. But about any particular individual or any particular dwelling, I know nothing except that he is a resident of this territory. Okay. The definition here, this definition of class probability, that at the same time are risks that are insurable. The definition implies the absence of any systematic redistribution, as I pointed out at the beginning. Because if I know nothing about any particular risk, except that this person or this dwelling is a member of some group with such and such a group risk, then all redistribution is, of course, random. And it applies also that the cases that are grouped together are, in a way, homogeneous. There's no way to distinguish between the various individual cases falling into the group. They all seem to be. And if they are homogeneous, that means to say that if and so insofar I know nothing about a particular individual within a group except that it belongs to this group, then and insofar as that is the case, they are the same. They are homogeneous. And lastly, this definition implies some sort of accident character of the risk that is insurable. It is something that happens. We cannot predict to whom it will happen. It just accidentally happens. And all we know is how frequently the group as a whole is affected by it. Now, by exclusion then, we can find out what risks are uninsurable, what risks have to be assumed individually, where no pooling of risks is possible. Risks that are uninsurable are risks where we can say that I know with regard to a particular risk, my risk or your risk, some or all of the factors determining its outcome. So if we know something that affects the risks occurring for event, can be taken out against it. Each individual person must take precautions in order to protect itself against the risk himself. In which way can each individual person do this? Mostly, of course, by means of personal savings, for instance. Now, what I want to point out in the next step is when we look at what sort of entities does this apply, that we know something about individual risks, then we can say this applies to the realm of individual actions. Individual actions are brought about by particular individuals with particular set of information, with a particular value scale, with particular technological knowledge, equipped with particular resources, their own property, which they use in order to engage in whatever action they engage. For actions, we always are in a position where we can distinguish between one individual and another, because each individual has, so to speak, different knowledge, different value scales, and so forth. I have control over my actions, and you have control over your actions. And because of this, every risk that may be influenced by my actions, and every risk that may be influenced by your actions, is strictly speaking uninsurable. And if something that was not controllable by our actions does become somehow controllable by our own actions, then something that was formerly insurable becomes an uninsurable event. Now, let's take a look at what that implies. Again, with respect to risks of the type of natural disasters, like floods and hurricanes and earthquakes and fires, insurance is obviously possible. The events are, so to speak, out of an individual's control. They are not the result of a purposeful individual action. I know nothing about my individual risk except that I'm a member of a group of individuals which as a group is affected by an objective risk frequency. On the other hand, take a risk like suicide. Can I insure myself against the risk of committing suicide? I certainly can insure myself against the risk of dying in the next year. But can I insure myself against the risk of committing suicide? And the answer is no, because I can, of course, bring this about at will, or I can also avoid it at will. Just imagine insurance company would offer something like this. That would attract, of course, all potential suicide candidates. They insure themselves, then they just put a bullet in their head, and then their wives or kids would collect whatever is $1 million premium or payout that would be paid in case of such an event. Takes a risk of my house burning down because I myself burned it down. That is, because I committed arson. Would an insurance company insure you also against the risk of committing arson, burning your own house down? And again, the answer would be no, you have perfect control, or at least semi-perfect control, over whether this event occurs or doesn't occur. This is something that falls into the realm of individual responsibility. Insurance companies would not cover risks such as this. Or take the risk of unemployment. You know, there exists something that is called unemployment insurance, but the fact that something is called some way does not mean that it is what it says it is. Unemployment insurance has, of course, nothing to do with insurance, because the risk of unemployment is also an uninsurable risk. What can we do in order to bring about employment individually, so to speak? Now, all I have to do is go to my boss, kick him in his behind, and I might lose my job. If my job is threatened, for instance, I might be willing to accept a wage cut, in which case my job might be preserved, whereas otherwise I might have to leave the job. So, yes, I do have control over being employed or not being employed. If you run out and offer your labor services for 50 cents an hour, you will be surprised how many offers you will get to employ you for 24 hours a day. So this is not anything that can be insured against, because we have individual control over the likelihood of this risk occurring or not occurring. What takes the risk of not feeling well in the morning and not wanting to get out of bed? Can we insure ourselves against this very unpleasant happening? And again, the answer is, I don't think you will find an insurance company that will take on cases such as this. And again, for exactly the same reason, this is something that that we have control over. With respect to these risks that I just mentioned, we are definitely not in the position where we would or could say, I know nothing about the particular risk of not getting up, or of committing suicide, or of being unemployed, except that I am a person, and that all persons are afflicted by these risks with a certain frequency. Right? This is what would have to be the case in order to make these sorts insurable. I know nothing about you or me that would make a difference. We are all somehow afflicted by this risk in the same way. And we all know that that is manifestly untrue in the case, or in the cases that I mentioned. We do know considerably more about these types of risks, unemployment, suicide, not getting up in the morning, because we can make these events happen, or we can make these events not happen deliberately. Or take an example where the control is not as obvious. Can I insure myself against the risk of making business losses? That is, could I go to an insurance company and say, can you insure me against the risk of making a loss in my business that I'm engaged in? And the answer is, of course, again, this is a typical case that no insurance company would ever insure you against the risk. Because what can you do? What can each individual individually do? They can deliberately make losses. All you have to do is just give yourself a super high salary and then produce a lousy product, and then you will see that you will be bankrupt. on top of it, produce a lousy product that makes it even more likely that you will go bankrupt. And again, we would not be in a position where we would say, I know nothing about my loss risk, except that I, as all other businessmen, are faced by the same group loss risk. As if a loss, business losses, so to speak, were something like being struck by lightning. They are not. Fractional reserve banking is, by the way, also something against the risks of which you cannot insure yourself. You know, as soon as you have fractional reserve banking, you have, so to speak, more property titles out there than you have property to back these titles with. And you can, by engaging in fractional reserve banking, of course, make the likelihood of a bank run higher or lower. If you have zero reserves, that is, you have no gold in the bank, but hundreds of thousands of tickets to gold in circulation, then the likelihood of a bank run is extremely high. If you have 100% reserves, that is, you have the same amount of gold in your vaults as the tickets that you have issued say that you do, then a bank run simply cannot occur, and you are, so to speak, safe from any type of bank run. So such a risk, of course, cannot be insured, nor can it be insured, for instance, that I change my mind or not change my mind. No insurance company would insure something like this. I insure you against the risk that you change your mind in the course of time. Now, with this distinction between accidental and insurable versus individually controllable and uninsurable risks in mind, what then about the possibility of health insurance? Now, you will immediately recognize that it is appropriate to display a certain amount of skepticism what the possibilities are as regards the possibilities of insuring yourself against health risks. Health or sickness risks are insurable only insofar as the health risk for a given group has a character of accidents. That would be the case maybe in accident insurance. That might be the case in situations where you are struck by cancer. That might be the case where you are affected by sudden bodily malfunctionings. But because most health risks, and with the advance of medical knowledge, more and more of such health risks fall within the province of individual control, that has become somehow susceptible to individual influence and control, very little in this field is actually insurable. And such risk then would have to be assumed individually and paid out of pocket or paid out of individual savings. By the way, that used to be the case in the old days when people typically had just a contract with a doctor. They paid him, so to speak, a monthly fee, and then the doctor was willing to treat you in the course of this year. So you had individual contracts with doctors, something that has fallen completely out of fashion. Now, it is noteworthy that in all recent talk about healthcare reform, this fact, namely that most of the so-called health risks are uninsurable risks, has hardly ever been noted by economists, except for Mises. Mises, already in his 1922 book on socialism, for instance, wrote the following. to the intellectual champions of social insurance and to the politicians and statesmen who enacted it, illness and health appeared as two conditions of the human body sharply separated from each other and always recognizable without difficulty or doubt. Any doctor could diagnose the characteristics of health, and illness was a bodily phenomenon which showed itself independently of the human will and was not susceptible to influence by will. And then he continues to say, now every statement in this theory is false. There is no clear defined frontier between health and illness. Being ill is not a phenomenon independent of conscious will and of psychic forces working in the subconscious. A man's efficiency is not merely the result of his physical condition. It depends largely on his mind and will. Thus, the whole idea of being able to separate, by medical examination, the unfit from the fit and from the malingerous, and those able to work from those unable to work, proves to be untenable. Those who believed that accident and health insurance could be based on completely effective means of ascertaining illnesses and injuries and their consequences were very much mistaken. The destructionist aspect of accident and health insurance lies above all in the fact that such institutions promote accidents and illness, hinder recovery, and very often create, or at least intensify and lengthen, the functional disorders which follow illness or accident. In order to underscore this, you only have to compare, for instance, employed people and self-employed people. And you will find that self-employed people work under conditions, continue to work under conditions, where employed people typically call in sick. They work frequently under far worse conditions because they have a completely different type of motivation. Underscoring Mises' point, being sick or being not sick is not just something that we can take a glass at and look at and then determine it is present or it is not present. It is something that is influenced to a high degree by the willingness to continue working despite certain problems that you might have with your body or by your unwillingness to do that. Now, in light of this, then, as far as health is concerned, one would expect that most health risks are assumed individually. And insurance, which always involves the pooling of risks, the forming of groups, would be limited to the accident variety of risks, of foreign-induced damage, of course, with strictly limited coverage. There would be no coverage of newly discovered risks, for instance. And, of course, with clearly specified payments, generally in the form of indemnity payments, cash payments, and possibly, but most likely this is considered to be less attractive by most clients, in the form of in-kind services that would be provided by specified facilities, provider facilities. Any further expansion of insurance in health matters would, if it takes place at all, be severely restricted to cases of small groups of people who, as buyers of identical individual health maintenance services from a specified provider, are thereby made extremely homogeneous. That is, if you have a very small group of people who all keep an eye on each other, that there are no people malingering around, then health insurance might be possible too. For very large groups where you cannot control whether people are pretending to be sick or are really genuinely sick, for all large groups that is essentially impossible. Now, if we look at the present reality of health insurance, then it is easy to recognize that this present situation has very little to do with the operation of free markets and the operation of freely competing insurance companies. It has very little to do with what we would expect from a freely operating insurance market to be brought about. In the medical insurance field, numerous uninsurable risks are in fact covered by the insurance industry. And I'll name a few as we go along. And in addition, manifestly different risk groups are grouped together in a joint pool, which yields, of course, a systematic, predictable income redistribution from lower to higher risk groups. The coverage in some cases is even undefined, especially in Medicaid and Medicare, and open-ended. And payments, respectively the service that you get, service amounts are likewise unspecified. It is not clear exactly what they will offer. In some cases, Medicaid and Medicare, covered is whatever it costs to do a certain thing. Governmental insurance programs are paying the bill. As if you had a house and your house burned down and your house cost only $150,000 and you are only insured for $150,000, as if you would now be able to build yourself a $250,000 house. Now, what is the reason for this perversion that exists in the current insurance industry? Insuring uninsurables and falsely grouping individuals. Now, this has been brought about by intervention into the health insurance market. Insurance against uninsurables and the non-discrimination between different risk groups is a result mostly of state mandates that have been imposed on the insurance industry. That is, if you want to operate an insurance company, you have to fulfill certain criteria that the government tells you. You can only operate if you do this and this and that. And now I want to read you some of these mandates. The number of these mandates has risen from 8 mandates that existed in 1965 to close to 1,000 mandates in the early 1990s. In the meantime, I'm sure there are far more than that. Now, these mandates, for instance, include the following. Insurance companies must cover the treatment of alcoholism in 49 states. Now, it should be perfectly clear that you cannot say of every person. We only know that you are a person, and some persons are affected by alcoholism. Some people are not prone to this affliction, and others are. In some families, you have just a run through the generations of alcoholics, and in others, you never had a single case. Nonetheless, whenever you take out insurance, you are covered with this. Even if you know that never applies to me and will never apply to me because I don't drink any alcohol at all, nonetheless, you have to pay the premium also in order to cover those for whom this risk exists. Drug addiction is covered in 27 states. That is if you want to operate as an insurance company in 27 states, you must cover this type of risk. It should be, again, perfectly clear that this is not a risk that applies to everyone equally. There should be at least subgrouping done. If not, it should be entirely excluded as uninsurable. The use of chiropractors is covered in 45 states. The use of podiatrists, foot doctors, is covered in 3 states. According to my non-systematic experience, I think women tend to have more foot doctor problems than men do. But that might not be the case. My personal experience. Psychologists, to go to a shrink, is covered in 36 states. Now, it should be perfectly clear that some people like to go to shrinks. So if you're bored at home, nobody's there to talk to, why not go to a shrink? Health insurance will pay for it. And I know other people who would never go to a shrink. I mean, they might be in the deepest crisis of their life, but nonetheless, they wouldn't want to talk to somebody else, a strange person, about their private problems that they might have. Regardless of what type of person you are, if you are this shy type that would never talk, go to a shrink ever, you must pay the price. You have to pay the bill also for those who love to go to them. Social workers, the same. Again, some people like to go to social workers. Others despise social workers, would never set foot into a social worker's office. But you must pay the bill regardless whether you belong into this group or not. Georgia requires coverage for heart transplants. The likelihood of having heart problems and requiring a heart transplant is also very different from one group to another group. Again, you just have to look at family history and you will already have a pretty good idea of how likely or unlikely this type of risk is. But it must be covered for all equally. Now we come into crazier things. Illinois requires that liver transplants have to be covered. So this is a subsidy, so to speak, for alcoholics. I assume that alcoholics tend to be more frequently in trouble with their liver and require a transplant. There might be other reasons for that as well, but certainly that group can be pinpointed rather easily. In Minnesota, the cost of hair transplants must be covered. And again, it should be perfectly clear. You only have to go through your family tree, and then you know, so my father was bald, my mother was bald, my grandfather was bald. So likely I end up with little hair myself. In my family, they all had hair until they died, so I'm pretty sure that this is a risk that never applies to me. In California, marriage counseling has to be covered. As you can imagine, you say once we come to the crazy states like California, more crazy rules appear. All these Hollywood types who have constant marriage problems and go to dozens of them, they, of course, get then subsidized by those who stay with the same woman all their lives. Pastoral counseling is covered in Vermont, and listen to this, sperm banking in Massachusetts. Again, that is a fitting tribute to the state of Massachusetts, that they have finally just made the decision that this is a worthy cause. So I'm pretty sure that the likelihood of people acting as sperm donors is also very different. Nonetheless, whether you plan to just give your sperms away or not, you have to pay for others to give them away. In more than a dozen states, and with a rapidly increasing tendency, insurers may not ask any AIDS-related question. Here we come to an instance of, so to speak, uninsurable risks. Yes, you don't contract AIDS if you live like a Catholic nun. That is as likely as being hit by lightning. But you can also engage in lifestyles where the contracting of AIDS becomes relatively high. Nonetheless, no questions related to this topic can be asked. In Washington, D.C., for instance, HIV testing is prohibited by all insurers. That is, you can come with a pre-existing condition, and the insurance company is forced to just cover these pre-existing conditions. In California, non-discrimination between any genetic trait is mandatory. They are not allowed to find out whether you have sickle cell disease, which is something that appears mostly among black men, or Tay-Sachs disease, for instance, which is something that you find more frequently among Jewish people. None of these distinctions are allowed to be made, despite the fact that we all know that they do affect the risk. Now, while these mandates might be advantageous for government, they can meddle around in these things. For the insurance companies, they are only some sort of mixed blessing. while they can cover more, even uninsurable risks, but while they do this, the cost and premiums must be continuously raised, and thereby larger and larger numbers of individuals are driven out of the insurance market altogether, and do without any type of insurance, even for genuine insurance risks, because they just don't want to pay these high premiums that all cover things that simply do not apply to them. You know all that screaming about, there are so many people who are uninsured. That there are so many people who are uninsured is the result of the perversion of the current insurance system that requires people to be insured against things which for most of us do not apply to us. And then you reach the point where you say, I rather run the risk of being without any insurance rather than supporting something with hefty premiums, of which I think that 90% of the things covered are simply not applicable in my own case. So what is then the next step in the interventionist process? The next step, which has not been taken in the United States, but of course in many other countries it has been taken, is because people drop out of the insurance and the premium for those remaining in the insurance pool go higher and higher, you now make health insurance mandatory. That is, you do no longer allow people to opt out. You must be insured. Now, if you do this, then the consequence will be that the premiums go up and go up. And we have situations where when insurers make losses, then they only have to appeal to the government and point out, look, last year we made losses, allow us to increase the premium, because it is easy to make losses, they make losses almost constantly, and in the consequence of making the losses, appeal and appeal and appeal again to the government, the premiums must be raised. So what does the government do then when the premiums go up and people get madder and madder and madder? Then, again, this is a step that has not been taken in the United States, but in many places it has, in Great Britain, Canada, and so forth. Then they introduce price controls. That is, then they tell the doctors and the pharmacies or whatever, only such and such a price can be charged for such and such a service. But what do you get when you introduce price controls in the healthcare business? Then you get, of course, shortages. Then the doctors will perform those tasks that are not price controlled and refuse to perform those tasks that are price controlled. And then there exist long waiting lists of people who want to get a kidney or want to get a heart transplant or want to have whatever, their bunion operated on their foot or whatever it happens to be. And when you have these shortages, what is then the next step that governments typically take? Now, then they begin to ration. So then they make up lists of good diseases and bad diseases, of things that deserve relatively quick treatment and things that are bad and deserve no treatment at all. So the government then comes eventually into the position of deciding about life and death of people. Have political diseases, then you are permitted to live. If you have politically incorrect diseases, then you will be put on the waiting list. Once you move up to place 101, you will likely be dead and never reach place number one. Now, where does all of this lead? Intervention in the insurance market creates an ever-increasing loss of individual responsibility, increases short-sightedness, and increases hazardous risks. Let me conclude with a quote from Mises, who says this: "The psychic forces, which are active in every living thing, including men, in the form of a will to health and a desire to work, are not independent of social surroundings. Certain circumstances strengthen them, others weaken them. The social environment of an African tribe living by hunting is decidedly calculated to stimulate these forces. The same is true of the quite different environment of the citizens of a capitalist society based on division of labor and on private property. On the other hand, a social order weakens these forces when it promises that if the individual's work is hindered by illness or the effects of a trauma, he shall live without work or with little work and suffer no very noticeable consequences and reduction in income. Matters are not so simple as they appear to the naive pathology of the army or prison doctor. Social insurance has made the neurosis of the insured a dangerous public disease. Should the institution be extended and developed, the disease will spread. No reform can be of any assistance. We cannot weaken or destroy the will to health without producing illness." Thank you very much.